And we're live now. It is the main course on Sunday morning. And somebody's talking. Fade that music down. This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with Patrick is back.
It's been a month.
Has it really been a month?
I've been saving up so much. I thought I would wait till this moment to announce that I have 8 hours of content. Guys, I hope you don't have plans.
That's right. I certainly don't, Patrick. I'm all ears. I want to hear, first of all, we have to hear, first, who's our sponsor, guys?
Yeah, who's our sponsor, Jack?
I forgot
Roberta's.
Oh, Roberta's Spray. Roberta's, 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Come here for the very best wood-fired oven pizza that you can find, as well as their incredible heritage pork chops, their fried chicken, their incredible Bloody Marys, their great beer selection, and much, much more. Roberta's is really the hot spot. It's the convergence of the happy meridian with the productive meridian. I've decided that they're on sort of that harmonic convergence meridian that makes everything that these owners touch turn to gold, and this is a golden spot. So anyway, with that out of the way, Patrick, full accounting of the last month. It was turkeys, all the time turkeys. Tell me about that.
Well, we're going to have Frank Reese on our next...
in the next hour
yeah. Part Q.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. I mean, you know, this Heritage Turkey Project, they are, you know, of the 270 million turkeys consumed in the United States each year, they're all one variety, the broad-breasted white.
Yeah.
With the exception of about 20, 25,000 turkeys, which represent probably about 25 other breeds, each with their own history, each, you know, with their own, you know, country like England or France, you know, that did something to the turkey and that, you know, bred it with their families, you know, traditions to communities and all of that. And, you know, it's very important to keep these turkeys around because... A, they taste a lot better.
Yeah.
You know, and B, they represent a genetic diversity that, you know, like the Dick Cheneys of the world have no right to decide whether their kind lives or dies. You know, I say the Dick Cheneys of the food world, you know, those big...
Well, I think we know who they're talking about.
Yeah, just guys who are so greedy.
Well, it's industrialized ag.
Greedy, 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 but it's even in their interest to keep one flock. That would cost, out of the $50 billion they make each year, would cost them probably a few tens of thousands of dollars to keep one farmer alive who's raising those other varieties. You know, because also for their own table, the CEOs, they should want a better tasting turkey. And it's just very tragic that they literally allowed these turkeys to become extinct almost until we came along. And now we're trying to, you know, create a viable market for them through eating them. And each year this project is a beast because all the infrastructure has been basically obliterated for little, small, tiny family farmers to become middle-sized farmers, you know, that can ship nationally and that can produce 10 or 20,000 turkeys. They've really been wiped off the face, you know, of American dinner tables. And so what we're trying to do is revive that tradition through a real active market. And so I actually, each year this Turkey Project is a beast because we always want to sell all the turkeys that are raised, but we never know exactly how many are going to come out.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you can guess more or less how many whole birds you get, but if there's like a little chip on the wing or there's a little discoloration, they cut it up into its pieces, breast meat, thighs. So you don't know how many whole birds you get. And then, you know, when we sell it to home chefs like you, Katie, who can get a FedEx box, or to restaurant chefs, you know that people order specific weights.
Oh, do I ever know that?
So, you know, when you get your 8,000 turkeys, you have to find out how many fell within each weight category.
Right. And it's 10, 12, 12, 14, 14, 16.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. And so if you
and people get very upset when they don't get exactly the right weight.
So if you have 600 orders for 14 to 16s, but you only got 550 birds in that weight range, you need to move 50 people over, usually within the wholesale.
Yeah.
You know, category, because mail order people spend like, you know, $200 on a turkey.
That's right. They better get what they ordered.
Yeah. And so it was a very, very big project. You know, I carried every single turkey, you know, from the truck into either the wholesale truck or into little individual boxes.
And then we're talking like 10,000 turkeys, right, Patrick?
Yeah. And we worked with Paradise Locker Meats, who was amazing. You know, they were really helpful. And actually this weekend I was in the town of Narragansett, which is one of the turkey varieties that we sell.
Oh, I didn't realize that. How great. Yeah. Are you buying those? Are the Narragansetts being actually raised in Narragansett, Rhode Island?
Well, no, you know, it's funny because, you know, a lot of people don't associate meat in the same way they do cheese. You know, people, no one would question bringing in a cheese from France.
Right.
Or a bottle of wine. But with meat, it's all local. It's got to be local. It's 100% local. But why? If it tastes better, it should be local. Mm-hmm. But those skills of the breeders, of the farmers who are the breeders and who select which male and which female are going to be kept and not killed so that they can breed the next generation, there's a talent in that.
Well, Frank Reese is going to explain that in the next hour.
There's a true talent.
He has definitely been one of the guys who does that.
And that talent should be defined by the talent, not by the number of yards they are from where you're buying it. That has nothing to do. That's a skill, like a talent, like a basketball player has a talent. So does Frank, and he happens to be in Kansas. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is certain meats taste better because of the breeds or because of the terroir, you know, the land. That has nothing to do with meters or yards or inches. It has to do with where is the best stuff. That's why Italians, you know, are proud of their chinina, which is in Tuscany. Whether they're in Sicily or Piedmont, they're proud of their chinina meats.
Right.
That is their thing. No matter where you are in Japan, Kobe, wherever the Kobe is being raised, that is their poster child meat. Same with the United States. So I just think that it's time that Americans wake up and understand that meats also, just like cheeses, just like wines, just because it's the closest doesn't mean it's the best.
Right.
And for instance, with turkeys, the Narragansett, just because, you know, there might
just because Narragansett was originally in Narragansett, Rhode Island, and part of the Narragansett Indian tribe.
It doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, a farmer who's might be trying his very best there, he might not really be raising the gold standard turkey just because he's 300 miles, you know, from you, or 200 or 100.
Well, I know, I remember hearing Bill Nyman say something similar. I forget whether it was in the paper or whether I was actually talking to him, but his point was that the cattle industry is best out in the grasslands.
Yeah, that's where it is.
It's really, that's where the food is best for the animals. It's where they have the most space to walk around. Mm-hmm. It's really, it makes sense that the cattle industry is based in the Midwest and the West.
That's 100%. And if we're talking about changing the way schools eat in the public school system, I mean, forget about upstate New York. I mean, it's just not the case, you know? And it's a, you know, this turkey project is always a kind of rite of passage. I mean, the other thing, there was some academic journal, some horrible, horrible guy wrote some academic journal article that he interviewed me for like 2 hours.
Really?
And did not mention heritage foods. And there is this real sad, just misinformation, you know, of people who don't understand that a farmer by himself does not necessarily have the desire, ability, know-how, or manpower to single-handedly create a flock, create the market for the flock, distribute the flock, accounts receivable and payable, inventorying, buying the extra inventory. It takes a marketing arm.
Absolutely.
So he wrote something for some academic journal that it was one of the worst pieces I'd ever read. His last name is Carlson, and I hope that they don't
they don't use his piece.
Well, it's just misinformation. Mm-hmm. You know, because you cannot do anything without a marketing arm.
Well,
if you're going
to
work beyond the CSA level where you raise the food, then you drive it.
And then you drive it around
and
to,
then you wait
know,
on the street corner for 3 hours and then you get people and then you drive back to the farm. That's a very romantic version. People who want to do that. But when you were trying to, for instance, feed Emory University, which is one of the accounts we just opened last year and we fed them again this year, you know, you need a group. Frank Reese cannot raise and sell 10,000 turkeys.
Right.
And so, you know, there's all this kind of
energy.
Well,
Frank can raise them, but he certainly can't then get them to market, right?
Yeah, and that's even a whole bird. So imagine pig producers, you know.
Yeah, who've got to cut it up.
Who've got to cut it up.
And
or
who
beef
have to find,
producers.
And who have to find a market for each and every piece of that animal.
So that guy Carlson is ignorant. And, you know, I hope Jack, you tag that.
Well, it all comes down to the distribution channel. Once again, it's
Carlson
it's
is ignorant.
Really about distribution. Okay. Well, that's enough about Mr. Carlson.
All right.
Patrick.
But it is.
Calm down.
It is. It's true. There is a whole world of change that needs to happen. And when that first little seed of change comes, everybody concentrates on that change. Who is it? Why is it? How come him? Where not? What is it? It's too expensive. And you're just like, dude. You know, the other thing is Alice Waters. The number of people who spend print pages trying to bring that woman down. And we're going to have Varun on later, Alice Waters' personal assistant. Where does that energy come? Go do something. Go well, do something. And if you're a journalist, report the entire story, not the political story, but, you know, what's really happening.
But I think you have to report the political story, because the political story is ultimately what determines in great measure the way people are swayed to vote, or with their dollars or with their actual votes, one way or the other. Are they going to support... Right. You know, this politician, like, say, Christine Quinn here in New York, who's been very active in supporting the green market, mm-hmm. or are you going to support somebody who's got, you know, some other person's special interest in mind? And that's, mm-hmm. you know, and they're saying, okay, we have much cheaper food than the green market. Of course, as we discussed last week, the green market is very competitive.
Very competitive. But, you know, for those people who stick their necks out and put everything they have on the line, like me with Heritage Foods or Frank with his turkeys, they get carte blanche. They get the passport. You can't rip those people down. Why? Because they put everything they know and own.
They're making an honest effort, and it's not about buying into the...
And they could go up or down based off of the Turkey Project.
Yeah,
their business could go bankrupt or not, so that the New York Times or any of these journalists or any of these people would either ignore some aspect of that story or be willing to... you know, not understand that they have not put their neck out for anything. And a guy like Frank Rees, he should be on the top 10 December Thanksgiving food list. How is he not on the top 10 every year? Marion Burroughs, she writes all these articles. Oh, these are the 10 best foods on the internet. Frank should be on the... It's not a varying top 10. Just like Zagat doesn't say, oh, we're going to cycle Babbo out of the number 29 rating because we did them last year.
Yeah,
it's fully ridiculous, you know? And I think that Slow Food came up with this idea of the Presidia, which is a garrison, a militaristic type approach to protect endangered farms and foods. If you're doing a Presidia and it works and it's honest and good, clean, and fair, you're gold. If you're not, either take a back seat and stay quiet or get on the ship.
Yeah.
But those who are doing it week in and week out and work 20-hour days to make something work, that's what this country should be about. And it shouldn't be about, you know, infighting within movements. It should be about positive support, just like Slow Food was built as a positive movement.
I agree.
Not one that brings the few success stories in the country down or wants to ignore a group as important as Heritage or Frank Rees.
Right. So, well, with that, I think we should probably take a break, right, Jack? And we'll be back in just a few minutes with Greg Hall, a master brewer. I'm so scared to take you away. I try to win her over from the start, but something always got in the way. We've been sitting in your backyard for hours, but she won't even come out and say hi. While my mother baked a little cake for you, and even dreaded when you said goodbye. What kind of car wheels do I have to pull? What kind of jokes should I lay out of now? I'm inclined to go finish high school just to make a notice that I'm such a jerk. I'm afraid to even open my eyes, because I really don't want her to judge me. I want her to really know who I am, and then and only then will she love me. Well, at least that was the plan. If ever a boy needed a holiday, if ever a girl needed someone to hold, just hope I don't act the same way by the time that I get that phone. We're back. We are sponsored by Roberta's. This is the Heritage Radio Network. We just finished our first segment where we covered the fact that Scott Carlson is not a good journalist and should not be writing for an academic publication. And now we are coming to talk about more positive things. We have one of my personal heroes, a guy who I've known for like 10 years back from Slow Food days. Cool.
Greg Hall from Goose Island Brewery, one of the more important regional brewers in America.
He's in Chicago, one of my favorite cities.
How are you?
Welcome.
Great to have you here, Greg.
Great to be here.
Really exciting. So what brought you to New York?
Well, we're selling a lot of beer in New York now, which is good for me because now I get to come for work and not just come here and just eat and drink.
To consume.
For, yeah. Now it's not a hobby anymore. Now it's work. So
cool. And now you were telling Ann and I earlier, you are moving a lot more beer into the New York State area or New England in general.
Yeah, New York, we've been out here for about 5 years selling beer, and it was kind of a trickle to start, and we've got some momentum now. So it's actually we're in 17 states, and New York,
wow,
as of October, just last month, is our number two state now.
So let's talk first about New York, because that's where we are, but then I'd like to deal with distribution and why it is so hard for brewers like you to go from that very local level to the regional. But which accounts in New York City, what are some of your accounts that excite you the most?
Well, certainly the real beery ones, like Barcade and Spuyten Duyvil in Brooklyn.
Spuyten Duyvil, okay.
Yeah, they do a great job. And then in Manhattan, the Gingerman, kind of Midtown-y, they sell a ton of beer.
Mm-hmm.
And then
it's been around forever, that place.
Yeah, the Gingerman, I'm like, wow.
I used to go there after concerts with my mom.
Absolutely.
Sweet. And then Blind Tiger down in the Village.
Sure.
How about the Burp Castle?
We've been in and out. One of the weird things about New York is like nobody has like a set beer list. You know, they rotate like crazy.
Well, there's so much beer being produced in this area. I think that's you've got a lot of competition here, especially in New York City.
Everybody wants to sell beer in New York. I mean,
and everybody wants to buy local too.
There's more. Well, there's more West Coast beer in New York than there is in Chicago.
Is that right?
Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff that I see out here. Obviously, I like to drink the local stuff here. Like I'm drinking some Sweet Action from
Six Points
right now. But I see all this West Coast stuff that I can't get in Chicago, too, because, you know, everybody wants to come to New York. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're also in
the nexus of Western civilization. Hello.
Minetta Tavern, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We got
Keith McNally's Empire.
Got our Nut Brown in there. We've got some beer at Prune. We've got some beer at Tabla. We did a beer dinner at Tabla.
Okay. With Floyd Cardoz.
Yeah. Did a great beer dinner during New York Beer Week back in September.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing a beer dinner at Tribeca Grill in January.
So you're in a bunch of restaurant groups. That's cool.
And then we do, I do a couple times a year, hopefully going to do a little bit more, do classes at Murray's, do beer and cheese classes.
Mm. We're going to have
Liz Thorpe from Murray's on later this hour, right?
Yeah, exactly.
She should be here now, actually.
To open this distribution question, which I know is a big thing for Katie also with these big companies and all that, like, how is it that there's more California beers here than in Chicago, and that Chicago beers have trouble being here and regional brewers becoming national ones? Like,
How do you grow that part of the business? Like, besides being a good salesman, I mean, like, how do you, because beer is,
It's just like five big breweries in the whole country, and then there's a bunch of little guys.
Yeah, there are a bunch of little guys. And in New York, there are the distributor we're with in Brooklyn is called Union Beer. And they are primarily an Anheuser-Busch distributor, but they ended up buying the portfolio from Brooklyn. Brooklyn Brewery used to self-distribute.
Yeah.
And then they decided they didn't want to do that anymore, so they sold a bunch of their portfolio, I believe, to Union. And the guy who used to be the sales manager, Robert Hodson, came over to Union. And now he not only sells a lot of beer, but he's kind of the chief recruiter. So basically, he's at all the craft beer conference and everything, like recruiting more beers.
So he's checking out what the new breweries are and microbreweries and working with some of the best of the best.
So they've got a pretty good good portfolio.
So he's really, this is the kind of guy who is what is needed in other parts of the industry, who is willing to take a flyer on small operations that have a smaller amount of product that they can produce, but that are really high quality. And I think that's probably the challenge in doing beer is that, I mean, how many, for instance, okay, Gooseneck sounds, did I say
Goose
that right?
Goose Island.
Sorry, Goose Island. Goose Island sounds like you produce a lot of different beers, but how many cases of each type are you able to produce? How big is your brewery?
Well, we're about this, a little bit bigger than Brooklyn Brewery in terms of how much we sell. We'll sell about 1.5 million, 1.6 million cases this year.
Of all the beers combined.
We started out as a brew pub in 1988.
Uh-huh.
So we started out just
in Chicago.
In Chicago. in the city, kind of Lincoln Park area.
Right.
And we started off just doing beers at the pub. And then we started distributing to about 20 accounts from the pub, from the little tiny brewery at the pub. And then in 95, we opened a bigger production brewery. And that's where we started distributing out of and doing our bottling out of.
So, and now, that was also in Chicago?
That's also in the city. And then in 99, we opened a second brew pub in the city right across from Wrigley Field. So now we've got two brew pubs and the one brewery, and they're all in the city. And
so your business is about 12 years old or 14 years old?
Started in 88.
In 88.
Yes.
So you're coming up on the 22-year mark.
Yeah.
Which is as old as it gets for microbreweries.
When did you get into it? Because you're a young laddie.
Yeah, well,
when did you get into the business?
I got in kind of the old-fashioned way in that my father opened the business. So he opened it up in 1988.
So how did he know that microbreweries and you know, this kind of beer was going to take off the way it's taken off? I mean, it has taken a while.
Oh yeah, yeah. He was in the paper business, obviously, and kind of grew up in that business in paper and packaging, and was on the financial side. So he was a bean counter for like a cardboard company, which is like the most boring job you could ever possibly imagine.
It sounds pretty dry.
He needed a beer.
Yeah. So he would he would have to travel for his job, and everywhere he'd go.
The only beer they were serving was Budweiser?
No. Everywhere he'd go from Chicago, he'd go out to the West Coast and drink Anchor, and he'd come out to the East Coast and drink
Ipswich.
Narragansett or something.
Oh my God, the worst beer in the world.
We were just talking about Narragansett.
I'm from Narragansett.
We were talking about the turkey, the place, and
I grew up on Narragansett beer. The worst beer in the world.
And then he'd go to South America, and he'd go to the UK, because they had plants all over the world, and he'd always go there and like meet with the local controller of the plant, and then they'd go out and drink beers, and then he'd come back to Chicago, where pretty much everybody drinks beer all day long, but there wasn't any local brewery. And he's like, it's really ridiculous that there's no local brewery.
Well, no, Katie, you know, Carlo always used to say, Petrini, that there are three things that make the United States more inspiring than Europe. Bread, cheese, and beer. And back in the 60s, there were five breweries.
Bam. Yeah.
That's it. And then all of a sudden it exploded.
It so exploded.
And it went in reverse, you know. It was like a diversity created, you know, after the fact from within, you know. But they make better Belgian beers and French beers and German beers in America than they do often in those other places, because it's not place specific. You know, it's a technique, you know, so you can make
it. You don't think the water has any impact on it? Come on, Greg. Let's hear from a brewer's perspective here. Your hops.
50 years ago, 100
years. Barley, 100 years, your malt. Well,
malt, barley, hops, yeast, three of the four ingredients are all very portable. Uh-huh. You know?
They're portable, but don't they? I mean, each one brings a very specific flavor.
Absolutely.
To the
but I can use the exact same malt, hops, and yeast that a Belgian brewer can. Exactly.
Are you going to get exactly the same product?
I can't get the same water, but water chemistry now is you can get pretty darn close.
Really?
50 years ago.
So you can actually alter the chemistry of your water to achieve a certain type of flavor. Now, that's a part of brewing I didn't know about.
Authenticity.
Let's talk a little bit about that.
And then the other cool thing is that while, you know, you've got this tradition of like monks and like, it's really more of a trade over there, brewing here. You know, we now, you know, I was an English major, but now we basically recruit chemical engineers and mechanical engineers to brew. They're 10 times smarter than I am. Mm-hmm. And they're the guys who brew. And they're, you know, they know more about science than monks do. You know, I mean, monks are super cool. I love.
Well, monks have years of tradition behind them informing their work. Mm-hmm.
And they eat so much. The monks were always the fattest people in the community, so they must have had a good palate.
Well, when the Catholic Church was supporting the monks and they didn't have the, you know,
if they weren't
Franciscans.
Well, they were, you know, they were the first commercial brewers. They were really the first restaurants and hotels. Mm-hmm. And all that's really cool. And I love that history. But that doesn't mean they can today make better beer than we can.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know? We can get the same ingredients, and then we've got kind of people that are a little bit more better trained to do it. And then we also have frankly better equipment, you know.
I was just going to say, I mean, you're able to control the temperature better, you're able to store it better,
we buy all brand new fancy stuff, and they're like, you go over there and you tour the place,
and they're still using
a 1946 Pepsi filler, you know. And
So what is your role? Are you more the palate then? You have all these young science geeks?
Yeah, well, you know, in the early days, I pretty much did the whole bit. You know, I'd make the beer, I'd write the ads, I'd deliver the beer.
Oh, how great, Greg. Come on, that's fun. That's terrific.
Yeah, and now I pretty much go to meetings.
You know? Now you're the face of Goose Island.
Well,
now
it used to be, people.
Yeah. Now, when people, you know, sometimes they'll be in a bar and they'll be like, you don't even make beer anymore. And I'm like, you know what? The company gets big enough, you have to either make beer or make decisions. So I make decisions now, you know, and we've got lots of people who are probably better at making beer than I am.
Yeah.
And, you know, because they understand the science extraordinarily well, and they basically come in and just knock it out time after time after time after time. Mm-hmm. And I'm easily distracted, so it's good that they're doing that. And then I get to go and talk about beer and food and drink beer and taste all these new beers and then say, hey, you know what? I had this really awesome beer over here and I brought a bottle back and let's taste it. I think we can make a beer this good or better. So let's do it.
Absolutely. So just because we didn't really, well, first of all, I'd like to have Jack tag on our website. What are your major beers that you raise? Like what should they look for besides Goose Island? What varietals do you?
Well, you know, Goose Island's kind of the brand name.
Right.
And then the styles that we sell the most of in New York, for instance, are India Pale Ale's the best selling beer for us. And
India Pale Ale.
It's a very traditional English style IPA, and we've been lucky enough to win 5 medals at the Great American Beer Festival with
that's fabulous.
That's that particular beer. So we think it's good, and other brewers do too, so that's good. Matilda is a Belgian style ale that's really cool because we ferment it with 2 different yeasts. We ferment it with a Belgian ale yeast to begin with, and then we do this super fancy old school yeast called Brettanomyces or Brett.
Well, when do you introduce that? I mean, I've made beer. I used to make beer with a friend of mine in my apartment building on Riverside.
Say Lockjaw?
It was absolutely fabulous beer. It was not cold aged. It was like we made things like IPAs and red ale and stuff like that. And it was really good, but I don't remember. I mean, we didn't ever. How do you introduce that second yeast?
Well,
like, when
do you
do that?
If you go back like 150 years ago, pretty much every beer, every wine produced anywhere was always like stored in barrels.
Yeah.
In wood barrels. And Brettanomyces likes to live in wood because it can actually live off cellulose. So probably every beer, every wine in the world, like pre-1870, had Brett.
Wow.
And then this jerk named Louis Pasteur came along and cleaned everything up.
What an ass.
Yeah,
I'm sure Liz has something to say about Pasteur.
Everything.
right. It's like,
we should take a minute to introduce. Greg, why don't you move over and then Liz can join the conversation since you're doing business with Murray's and Liz Thorpe is here. Greg Hall, meet each other. And Liz Thorpe is here from Murray's to talk about the new deal she cut with Kroger's. But we're going to go to that in a break. But now, since you've done business with Murray's and you've done like cheese and beer dinners and stuff like that, let's bring her into the conversations as long as she's here.
So is Pasteur an ass?
Are you kidding? Pasteur was the greatest thing that ever happened.
He cleaned everything up.
Yeah. He cleaned up the milk supply, you guys. I mean, otherwise people were dying from milk-borne
diseases. He saved a lot of people from dying.
He opened the door towards pasteurizing everything.
He did. That's why
Without
we call it pasteurizing.
Without him, it would be all raw milk. It would all taste
That's right.
better.
The cheese would taste better, but the milk would be killing us.
just finish your list.
What you were saying, Greg.
So that was Matilda was the second. And what makes it Belgian? Is it the yeast?
Yeah. So what we do with this beer is we actually do a primary fermentation. Then we do a second primary fermentation with this Brett.
Okay.
And it's all in stainless. And then we blend them together and we ferment it a third time and then we bottle it. And it ferments kind of a fourth time in the bottle. So,
and that's called Matilda.
It's called Matilda. Mm-hmm. So it's very spicy. You know, very
sounds delicious.
Yeah, and it's just water malt hops and yeast.
What does a 6-pack of that cost for the most part?
We don't sell 6-packs; we sell 4-packs.
Okay,
and a 4-pack.
So that
probably
means it's expensive
in New York. Yeah, probably about $12. And then
for a 4-pack, that's not bad.
Because you don't need to drink.
It's not
10
as bad
of them.
As like Samuel Smith, which was like $6 a bottle
right,
and
which,
a 4-pack.
The crazy thing is,
painful.
If you go over to England, it's,
and I really
it's
liked
the cheapest
it.
Beer.
Sam Smith
is the cheap. It's like the Pabst over there. It's cheap.
Yeah. That's another beer that we drank a lot of in Rhode Island when I was growing up. Pabst Blue Ribbon. Oh, yeah. And the second worst beer in the world.
It won a Blue Ribbon.
Yeah, back in about 1885.
Yes. So tell us, there's the Matilda, and then what other ones are your pale ale, Matilda?
Bourbon County Stout, we release that every year. That's a really fun beer too.
What makes it Bourbon County?
Well, and why do you only do it once a year?
Well, we
why did you choose the word stout?
No, yes, just and let's interrupt you again. Sorry, Greg.
It's we started making it in 1992. I wanted to do something really special for our 1,000th batch of beer.
Cool.
Wow.
And I did a beer and bourbon dinner with a gentleman by the name of Booker No. And Booker was
I'm sold right now.
The master distiller, the fifth master distiller at Jim Beam.
Oh.
And I think he was the first non-Beam to be master distiller.
How do you spell
distiller. No? N-O-E.
Okay.
And if you've ever had Booker's bourbon, that's him.
Okay.
So I talked him out of some bourbon barrels, and we made this really big Imperial Stout and aged it in bourbon barrels for only about 100 days, the first one. And
what does that do to it?
That sounds delicious.
It makes it taste kind of bourbon-y.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gives it like a smoky...
Yeah. And then so we made it like every year,
Greg.
Once one batch at our brew pub. And then in 2004, I think, or 2005, we made our first batch that we bottled. And now we make more every year. Now we actually.
So did you have to buy more bourbon barrels in order to?
Well,
keep,
yeah, we use new barrels
you
every
time.
You
cannot get that flavor without using a bourbon barrel, right?
Right. And we never use a bourbon barrel twice.
Right.
Because
then it just tastes like beer.
Well, it tastes different. It doesn't taste the same. So.
Uh-huh.
Now we, like this year, we
bought... So this is the ultimate sustainable beer, because you're like recycling bourbon
barrels.
Because
you're throwing a bunch of stuff out after one-time use.
Well, then they... Well, that's
well,
true.
No,
but
no,
then
no,
you're
no,
using
no,
the bourbon
we,
barrels.
No, I know, yeah.
We actually reuse the bourbon barrels, and then we give them to... Who do we give them to? Sierra Club, who uses them for rain barrels.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so
imparting a very lovely taste.
I thought you were
going to
say we give them to Sierra Nevada, who make a lesser bourbon,
or
but,
a lesser beer.
Lesser beer, yeah.
But we actually buy now about 1,200 barrels. We bought this year.
Wow!
So we have a warehouse that's just full of bourbon barrels.
What does a barrel cost, if I can ask?
Depends on where you get them. We get now most of them from Heaven Hill, and we get like all the Elijah Craig barrels. So we get mostly 18-year-old and 12-year-old barrels, and then we also try to get all the barrels that Julian Van Winkle III uses for Pappy Van Winkle. So we get the 23-year-old barrels, and those are really, really good barrels.
Nice.
Yeah.
And are all these beards you've been talking about available all across the country? Or
we're in
Can
17
you mail
states.
Order them?
We're in the upper Midwest, and then New York. We just opened up Boston, D.C., and then... mail order is kind of tricky for beer.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Although they do have that Beer of the Month Club. I mean, I gave that to my brother-in-law for Christmas one year.
there are some, like in Chicago, there's a chain called Binney's, and they will ship if it's allowed in your particular state.
Ah, right. Because each state does have regulations about whether or not you can move alcohol through the mail system.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about Prohibition is basically they totally said, you know, I don't believe in the Interstate Commerce Clause, and we want different rules for every state to make things as complicated as possible.
And
we're going
to
keep those laws on the books until
But I do have two more questions, and then we can open it back up.
And then we'll move
Liz
into our Liz Thorpe segment. Here though, Greg.
Yeah,
okay.
Greg. I wanted to ask, in terms of distribution, why was it that 20 years ago you could only find Budweiser around the country? What happened? Is it because what Katie said, that like the bigger distributors have decided to take smaller breweries under their wing to diversify? Or like, could you describe that change?
I think it's mostly because the drinkers have demanded it. You know,
I think it's consumer driven also.
Okay. Yeah,
it's a few local breweries were able to move their stuff into stores or into pubs and brew pubs, right? And then that developed a consumer thirst, as it were, for that product or for a better quality product.
Thanks, Katie.
It's another thing you can blame
on. Yeah, right. Let me
be
the expert here, Patrick. That's right. Yeah, Greg, shut up.
Kidding. Come on.
When we first started, if you wanted to learn about beer, you had to buy a Michael Jackson book because that was it. There's an English
I'm guessing
beer
that's
writer.
Not the recently deceased
no,
Michael
no,
Jackson.
No, 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 not the pedophile.
No.
That's the come on. I don't think he was a real pedophile. You're
of course
talking
he
about
was.
The no, I don't think it was. But I think
have you ever been in Neverland?
Kids. No, but more kids would have said, "Mommy, he touched." Like, I think he crossed lines a little bit, but I think he slept with kids, but I don't know that he touched them and all that stuff. Anyway,
innocent.
Michael Jackson is the
well, he loved kids.
He loved
that doesn't
kids.
That's well, he had a file for
All right. Well,
but was he a card-carrying member of NAMBLA? I don't know.
You're talking about Michael Jackson, the famous English red-bearded expert.
Yes, the beer writer. That basically, you know, you'd get like Simon and Schuster's Pocket Guide to Beer by Michael Jackson, you know, or the World Guide to Beer by Michael Jackson, and that was like it, you know, if you want to learn about beer. And now with, you know, the internet, basically you can be in, you know, Wichita, Kansas, and know everything there is to know about beer in real time, because
there is an unbelievable amount of beer publications, as I've discovered, because I do a cooking class in the bar underneath my apartment. Huh. And they have just changed their beer program to do like all local beers, because they want to like capitalize on that, because they need business. So I wrote a press release for them, and they have 6 new beers. Sorry to talk about myself, but what was interesting to me, to go back to what you were saying, is that when I looked up each and every one of these beer sites, I was amazed at how, and then I was looking for places where we could send the press release out. It was unbelievable how many beer publications, beer blogs, beer magazines, beer, you know, just everything, all thing beer, that we could access in terms of sending out.
There's a lot of really good, like, consumer-driven type ones, like Beer Advocate.
Yes, that was the one that I was really impressed with. And Ale Street News was really good also.
And Charlotte Papasian, which is my next question, Association of Brewers, and they're melding with that other association of the bigger regional brewers. I wanted to ask that. But, I mean, they had their own publication too, right, out of Boulder?
Right, right. The New Brewer. It's a good one. There's a lot of good beer stuff out there. There's Draft Magazine, and Beer Advocate's got their own magazine now, and that's a good one. Ratebeer.com, beermenus.com. There's just so much good beer stuff out there now.
And
there's
thus
so
the much consumer good beer. Demand.
Well, I think you guys, we should take a break and bring Liz into the conversation.
Wait, wait, I do have one last question. I mean, we're going to go till 2:15. So, right?
Till
1:15.
Okay.
I mean, right? Isn't that our usual main course timeline?
Sure. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask about this. Association of Brewers used to be an independent, small group started by Charlie. And then they ended up melding with a group of regional, bigger, like Sierra Nevada, you know, I think Sam Adams, Brooklyn Brewery. What is the state of brewing now? I mean, how did that melding work? I mean, is the small brewer helped?
Well, I think, you know, what's happened is that there used to be kind of two brewing communities. There was like the bigger business-like brewing community that like cared about distribution and cared about taxes and cared about sustainability for the industry. And then there were a bunch of, you know,
super small
tattooed guys who wanted to make awesome beer and
almost homebrewers, right?
Right.
It was connected to the homebrewer.
Yeah. And, but you know what, as they got bigger, all of a sudden they started worrying about distribution and taxes and everything else. It's, you know, it's a business, you know, it's,
and it's hard work. So it's not like, you know,
that's the difference between, you know, and then I don't know how many of these small brewers started up with 100% of their own money. I mean, somebody gave them money and wants money back out of this thing. So you kind of got to make money. So everybody's kind of in the same boat now, you know, and there isn't this big divide between, you know, the big brewers suck and the small brewers are cool. It's kind of like we're all brewers and we all, you know,
unlike in the food business.
Unlike in the food business,
you know, we fill, you know, different needs.
That's right.
And one of the cool things about beer is beer's always been both kind of as an adult beverage, an alcoholic beverage, both the refreshing one and a tasty one. You know, so
like, and a good one to pair with foods.
Yes. And so
people are getting more and more tuned into.
And in fact, beer pairs better with foods in terms of its marrying itself to the taste of the foods than wine does.
I don't know if it's
which
better.
Which cuts across.
I think it depends on the food.
It depends on the food. I think so. Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, we did. And this is a nice segue. In 2008, the ACS, American Cheese Society, had their conference in Chicago, and I've been lucky enough to speak a couple other times at ACS events about beer and food. So when there's coming to Chicago, I said, okay, we got to do the beer wine smackdown.
Smackdown.
I like it.
Oh, I don't know what the sound is.
Where's the
smackdown
button?
Don't give him a sound effect.
I don't have my menu. I don't know which one.
The cock down there. That's right.
One of the number one bluegrass bands.
Hey, Beauty,
in the
weren't you guys talking about that this weekend, huh?
My friend Toby represents them. So
Beauty,
I'll
I
bring
like
us
that a
back.
Lot.
We're at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Patrick Martins with Katie Kiefer. We have Liz Thorpe and Greg Hall as guests, and our sponsor is Roberta's, which makes some of the best pork chops, pizza, salads. It is literally one of the top five restaurants. In the city, I think.
261 Moore Street in Bushwick.
Right.
Take the L train to Morgan Avenue, walk 1.5 blocks.
So far today, we've covered some fascinating things about beer. We've also covered that Scott Carlson is a bad journalist and should not be writing for academic publications. And now we are going to the final thing.
Let's introduce our new guest who came in the earlier in the segment, was very discreetly polite and not chiming in on everything. But Liz Thorpe is with us. She's the vice president at Murray's Cheese. And she has joined our guest, Greg Hall, from Goose Island Brewery. And Liz, I was absolutely fascinated to read in the National Association of Specialty Food Trades, which is a online newsletter, which I receive daily, that Murray's Cheese has cut a big deal with Kroger's supermarket chain.
Yes.
So I wanted to just get to the bottom of that. I know you guys had a little pilot program with them. You were already in a few stores. I'm assuming that those stores were in more affluent neighborhoods around the country. Kroger's, it should be mentioned, even though it's not a we don't have Kroger's here in the Northeast, but it is probably the largest supermarket chain in the rest of the United States. So tell us sort of the genesis of this deal. You started out with like 5 stores.
Yeah.
I mean, you're expanding into 17 more, which is really big.
Well, yeah, the genesis actually started about 5 years ago. This has been a long conversation that I've been working on for 5 years as of November. But we launched a test program a year ago. We actually did Murray's Cheese store within a store concept. So we took over the cheese program in the deli departments of 3 stores. And we did this in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is where Kroger is headquartered. Mm-hmm. And the stores were picked, I mean, actually not necessarily in affluent areas. I mean, they're definitely some of the bigger, busier stores, but one in particular has a very wide cross-section of shoppers. And so basically the idea was we would do a test to see how the test went. And then if the test went well, we would talk about doing more. And the test has been a huge success.
What was the test? Like what types of cheeses?
Yeah, what did you sell?
Because, I mean, was it more expensive cheeses? Or?
We literally, we took over the entire cheese program. So this idea, and I was hearing a little bit of this as I was walking in, but the idea of sort of like good cheese versus bad cheese is not an idea that I subscribe to. To me, cheese is cheese, and there's more expensive and perhaps more specialty.
Wait a minute, Liz. Wait, stop. You're telling me that Alpine Lace...
No. I'm not saying there isn't.
Jarlsberg cheese are
Jarlsberg good is one of our top 10 sellers at Murray's.
Well, of course, it's the top 10 seller. I mean, I worked at Pasta and Cheese. I got my cheese creds down. We sold a ton of Brie and a ton of Jarlsberg, but that didn't make those the better cheeses.
No, definitely not. But I think that the idea to me that block cheddar is sort of not worth our time and we only want to talk about specialty cheeses made by small farmers is not something I subscribe to. To me, there's a whole spectrum of cheese, and there's the cheese that people use every day, the cheese I use every day. I don't have, you know...
Block cheddar is one
of
the ones I use every day.
I don't have Vacher and Mondor in my fridge every day, although I did, you know, serve it on Thanksgiving. But they had been separating the cheeses. They had been sort of putting fancy cheese over here and everyday cheese over there, and we put them together because we wanted to
so
talk about all of them.
So that marketing plan actually was very successful for you. In other words, you could combine Alpine Lace with, which has its market. I mean, its place. I don't like it, but it has its place, with something like Vacheron, and people were like able to sort of...
Wait a second. I still don't understand. You guys are talking over my head. What was this experiment? So you took over the Kroger's thing.
A branded store within a store. It's a 650 square foot U-shaped cheese shop.
That's a lot of retail
space. And what cheeses did you have? Is it just like Murray's transported?
In many cases it is. So for example, we don't sell Alpine Lace because we wouldn't sell Alpine Lace at our own
regular store. In your flagship. Okay.
Right. But it was, it is about 150 cheese SKUs plus all the stuff that goes with cheese. So crackers and quince paste and nuts and fruits and honeys and all that stuff.
Beer.
I do a lot of cross merchandising with beer, which is something we can't do here. Let's talk afterwards.
Yeah.
Have a pizza. You know, it's definitely, you know, it's block cheddar, it's Havarti, it's cave-aged Gruyere, it's Parmigiano Reggiano. And then it's Tome de Savoie and Saint-Nectaire and, you know,
so the
10 different
quality,
kinds of blue cheeses. And, you know, so it's definitely, it's not as big as Murray's here in New York. We have about 250 cheeses at any given time, but it's comparable. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how many do you have? How many cheeses?
About 150.
That's a lot.
And so, Liz, are you able to promote any of the American artisanal cheeses, or those are beyond the price point? Because I find them prohibitively expensive.
And did they dictate a price point to
Much as I would
to
love
guys?
To. Yeah.
We define the selection. That's part of our expertise, and part of what we bring to this is that we can put together a well-balanced and diversified selection of cheese, and we also are really good at buying and sourcing. So that's a big part of what we bring. And one of the things we were noticing that was really weird was that they had, like, I mean, and this is very, very supermarkety, very American supermarkety, you know, six different kinds of everything. So it's like, if you're going to have sharp white cheddar, then like find the best sharp white cheddar and have that. Don't have six different sharp white cheddars because Mrs. Smith likes that brand and Mrs. Jones likes the other brand. And so we did away with a lot of that. And what that meant was we kind of got behind the products that we really, and the producers that we really thought were the best and the most suited to that, you know, volume, that environment, whatever. And we do have American artisan cheeses. We have, you know, some of the more expensive ones like Pleasant Ridge Reserve. Mm-hmm. But we also have, I mean, and this was something that I was really adamant about, a lot of the everyday cheeses that people know and love are made here in the United States, and they're just as good as the imported versions. And I know, particularly in Wisconsin, a lot of these small family-owned and cooperative-owned factories that make cheeses like Havarti and Smoked Gouda. And I wanted to support those people. Uh-huh. And so we have a lot of those, a lot of the Rough kind of the everyday are coming from producers here in the States.
Do you change the selection of cheeses according to which markets you're going into? Is there a lot of sort of hand selecting for each individual city?
Yeah, now that we're expanding, and actually the expansion deal is 50 stores over the next 36 months.
Holy Toledo, girl. So you could be a busy girl.
So all over, busy. You say the Toledo, so you're still concentrating in the Midwest, Cincinnati, Toledo.
No, I think she meant Holy Toledo.
Oh, Holy Toledo.
It's kind of like Jiminy Cricket.
I am Batman. Drinking too much for Nebronco over here.
um, We're in the Cincinnati division now. We have 4 stores. We will expand. We'll have about 12 when we're done with that division. So it won't be every store in the division. It will be the stores that we think are best suited to this program. And that tends to be the more affluent areas, although some of the stores are really diversified. But we're going to be expanding to other divisions across the country, and Kroger operates everywhere except the Northeast.
Right.
So it's pretty wide open.
Wegmans didn't let them in, huh?
They stayed out of the Northeast.
Well, we have a lot of strong chains in the Northeast.
Makes sense.
I'm not surprised they didn't want to try to.
They've never. It's also a really expensive market, apparently, to break into, but they operate stores under other banners. So, for example, if you're in California, if you've ever shopped at Ralph's or, you know, King Supers in Colorado, those are Kroger. Those are owned by Kroger, but they don't operate under the banner Kroger. Mm-hmm. So we could be going anywhere.
And how have the people received it?
Really? I mean, the people, like the customers?
Yeah.
Or I mean,
have they sold more cheese as a result?
Yeah.
Has it been a successful enterprise for them?
Definitely. That was a pretty key metric for whether we were going to expand.
But
I'm saying,
deal.
How do you judge success? You know,
well, we saw 30-70% sales increases. So that was a major way.
Are you doing melts?
No, not yet, but we want to next year.
You mean like sandwiches, prepared foods?
Nice. Yeah, we're doing, we've started.
There's only one Nina, though.
Yeah. We've started, you know, we've always had panini at Murray's, but we started doing a line that we call Murray's Melts, which is more like a traditional grilled cheese, buttered white bread, or, you know, whole wheat bread, whatever. And yeah, we'd like to sell
like to expand
grilled cheese sandwiches. Thank you.
Well, 650 square feet of space in a supermarket setting is a lot of real estate for a cheese counter, it seems to me. So let's talk a little bit more about how they decided, like the metrics. You're saying that the metrics of how much more you sold in those pilot 5 stores is dictated the amount of space that they've been willing to give you.
Well, they already had a specialty cheese store model. And it's actually something that exists in, I think they've got specialty cheese shops now, and I'm not going to say the number because I don't know. I know in the Cincinnati division there are 20 that already had what they were calling a specialty cheese shop, which was this 650 square foot unit. And when I say unit, I mean like it's a case, and it's got an olive bar attached to it, and like that thing already existed.
I gotcha. Okay, we have that in our local Stop and Shop in Rhode Island.
When we tested, we actually kind of played with the equipment and changed the design a little bit. So we tested 3 different physical models that were all about the same size, and based on, you know, what worked and what didn't, we've kind of refined that, and now we're
do you have
forward.
A person, an actual person there who's talking about cheeses?
Yeah, and how do you educate
the
them?
How do you do the education?
Yeah, the buying and sourcing is, I would say, you know, the first 50% of really what we're bringing to the table, and the second 50% ongoing is training and education. So
have you kept the same people on who were there before, or have you had to, was that a challenge because maybe they didn't, you know, care?
Definitely. I would say people is always the biggest challenge, and turnover and, you know, maintaining a level of knowledge, but also I would just say a level of enthusiasm and interest and passion, which is something that we all really have at Murray's. I mean, everyone who works there really genuinely is psyched about cheese. We actually have a person who's responsible, a position we created that's a divisional position, someone who oversees the cheese shops. And it's very much a sort of train the trainer model, you know, because we can't be there all the time. So the idea of creating like an ongoing certification program that has levels where you're kind of like always advancing up a ladder and getting more knowledge and more expertise as you go is the model that we're using. Mm-hmm. But we have this person who sort of oversees the stores at division level, and then we, you know, like I'll be going out to Cincinnati in a week and a half to open a new store, and we do a 4-day on the ground training program.
It's where Paul O'Neill's from, my favorite Yankee of all time, and Molly O'Neill's brother.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing, Pat.
No problem.
So we go out, we open with them, we do training on the ground, and then we go back. We're constantly visiting and following up and working with them at store level. So it's intense, labor intensive for us as well.
When you're marketing those cheeses and you're bringing new cheeses into the market, like say, okay, you have your basic product brand, I mean, your product line, and then you want to introduce a couple of new ones. Mm-hmm. Are you able to like hook up with somebody like Greg and do a cross promotion in a market like that and like really sort of generate a lot of excitement and educate people about new cheese, new beer, new wine, new whatever. Because I think in a lot of states, Kroger's can sell beer and wine, right?
Yeah, it's awesome. I wish we could do that here in
the city. No kidding.
We do, I mean, on an informal basis, a lot of kind of what it means to be a Murray's is our merchandising style. I mean, when you walk into the store, they feel and they look a certain way. And we do a lot of those kinds of merchandising exercises at store level, and we do a lot with cross merchandising with wine and beer, and we've actually seen increases in wine sales in the stores where we operate above and beyond what the division is doing.
Can you imagine that, Greg? Why wine?
So
go figure.
Well, they have them combined. So I guess when I say wine, it's the alcohol department sees a spike.
But traditionally, you think of wine and cheese, and really beer and cheese is a great mix also.
Yeah, it's a great mix. So food, all their seminars were first seminars.
I don't know, the
started.
SmackDown, man, beer always wins when we do SmackDowns. Yeah. Every time.
You know, Garrett Oliver and Rob Kaufelt were the two, you know, kings of seminars. They were the first Americans to go to cheese, you know, and it was always about introducing beer, you know, as a... Yeah. Is it true that Rob goes to every single person's house in Cincinnati to thank them for their purchase?
No, we're going to put him on the road. We're putting him on the road next year.
Yeah. Liz, just we're coming up on the hour here, and we're going to only go for, I guess, for about another 10 minutes.
Yeah, but combine and actually talk about what they talked about at their seminar for the last segment.
But let's talk for a second, because Liz is just publishing a book, so we should promote your book a little bit here. Oh, yeah. What's
the
title?
I brought a copy for you guys. It's called The Cheese Chronicles, and
And who's your publisher?
It's in my handbag if you want to grab.
Is that it?
No.
That's a bad book. You were making bad faces about that book.
That's bottom feeder.
I don't like that book.
Can I see your book?
Yeah, it's in my bag if you want to grab it.
So, Liz, tell us about The Cheese Chronicles.
It's called The Cheese Chronicles. It's published by Echo, which is a division of HarperCollins.
Oh, so you worked with Dan
Halpern.
Halpern. Yeah, I know him well. Yep. Sure.
Wow.
So,
for some reason, Dan Halpern knew that I would know. I used to do publicity for books.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in a conference.
God, you've done everything.
Well, it's because I'm in my 50s. and I'm a jack of all, you know, I have a very short attention span, so I have to keep doing different things. But anyway, I was promoting books, and I was in a conference with Dan Halpern. And I like Dan, but anyway, so we're in this conference room, and it's me and like another 11 women and Dan. And I'm sitting, for some reason, I get stuck with the other end of the table, and he looks at me, and we're talking about...
You were below the salt?
I was way below the salt. We were talking about Teddy Atlas, the boxing trainer, because we were promoting his book, and they were not doing a great job of publishing it. But anyway, the point is that at some point during the conference, he looks at me, and he says, well, it's kind of like Robin Bird and blah, blah, blah. And no one else at the table but me knew who Robin Bird was. And I thought to myself, how did you know?
That I'm the one who's going to get it.
And all the other women at the table were like, who's Robin Bird? Who's Robin Bird?
Well, I find this cheese segment has been way, way interesting.
Way good.
So let's take a minute break, and then I have a couple questions that's going to throw it back blowing this up into the national, international stage.
Yeah.
Sweet Betsy, my fair prairie rose, so slender and pale in your mail order clothes, all decked out in ruffles and ribbons and rings. You're just like an angel, only wear. Are your wings? Oh, Betsy, sweet Betsy. Let's change your name and stake a claim where cares will never find us. Oh, Betsy, sweet Betsy. We'll hitch our dream to a 20-mule team and leave the world behind us. Whoopee tie. There's love in them hills far away. Whoopee tie. Waiting for Betsy and me.
So we're back on the main course.
Yeah, that's right. Main course. Main course. Heritage Radio Network, sponsored by Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Patrick Martin is the guy you just heard there. He's been absent for so long.
I have an
long.
S at the end of my name.
Yeah, Martins. Yeah, I said okay. that. I said that. Martins. Sure. Yes, exactly. But Patrick has been gone for so long. You know,
I'm like exploding. We're going to go on. I'd like to go on another 3 hours.
We're just
going to
keep on going until, yeah, exactly.
With this segment.
Well, you have so much cool stuff to talk about. And we are in the studio today with our guests, Greg Hall from Goose Island Brewery in Chicago, and Liz Thorpe, who is Vice President of Murray's Cheese, who has just published a book called The Cheese Chronicles, and who is here to tell us about her fascinating new campaign, or I guess new expansion into the Kroger's supermarket chain, which I think is just so fascinating. It means it has so much resonance on so many mm-hmm. levels in terms of the
Chicks
education
to the core.
It does, in terms of the education of the American consumer about better food mm-hmm. and even if you're buying block cheese, it's better quality block cheese. And I know that they're selling a lot of really great cheeses like Saint Nectaire and Morbier, and you know, the sort of the usual suspects, but the usual suspects.
How do they
have
that ash in there?
Well, Liz
can tell
you.
It's two layers.
Yeah, it's morning milk and evening milk.
They fill the mold up halfway with curd, and then they put the ash on, and then traditionally they would finish it the next day. But
so I want to name names. We named Scott Carlson as a bad journalist, so now let's go positive now. And I want to hear about, and then I'll ask this to Greg about beers, notes on the pioneers of new American cheese. Give us some pioneers, a couple of pioneers that you want to mention on radio.
Pioneers would be people who started making cheeses in this country when nobody wanted them. So people like Mary Keene at Cypress Grove out in Humboldt County, California, started making goat cheese in the early 80s.
Igvella?
No, nobody wanted goat cheese back then. Igvella.
Except for me, yeah.
Yeah.
Really, it was just a really little handful of people who were even
Paula,
into goat
Paula
cheese.
Paula Lambert in Dallas, Texas,
oh,
wanted
mozzarella.
To make, you know, real yeah. mozzarella made by hand, and that was wacky and crazy. You know, Miles Kahn up here at Coach Farm.
Coach Farm. So, old goat.
Old goats.
And then it was bags and then became cheese, right?
Right, exactly. But just the idea that these people, and it was, I mean, primarily women actually, were making styles of cheese that were not familiar to the American public, and generally from a lot of goat milk, which was a new thing, and really lost a lot of money and worked really hard and got no respect and no love for, you know, 15 years.
That was Ernest Hemingway, I think, was just
here
trying in front
to,
of
really trying cool. to
I thought he was gonna
beat the glass.
The window.
Well, he's really trying to distract
he
you.
He hates radio. Who were some,
or he thought this was a
Judy
TV
Shad?
Show.
Yeah. Judy Shad would be another yeah. one. Yeah, totally.
The hottest grandmother of all time, she describes herself as.
Oh, really? Yeah, she's in the book. She's the only lady I know who can like wear lipstick, maintain a perfect manicure, and milk 70 goats at one time.
That's so funny. Now, Greg, who would you put on that level, having heard those cheese people who you know, who would you put on the beer level for the same category?
Certainly, you know, there's a lot of great brewers out there now, and there are more than ever. You know, back in the early days of the Great American Beer Festival, I'd only stick to the people I know because I knew that their beer was good and some of the other stuff was kind of sketchy. But now there's so much good beer out there. But the ones that I kind of go back to over and over again, Sierra's great, Sierra Nevada, you know, and it's so widely available. And it's kind of your go-to beer when, you know, wherever you are, you can
when
always
the local
get a,
craft
you
can, brew you can is always, not necessarily
well, you can always get
there.
A Sierra somewhere, you know, and that's go-to. Garrett does a great job, Garrett Oliver. And
Brooklyn Brewery.
You know, I think now that he's really getting into things like Local Number One, mm-hmm. you know, it's so good. I love that kind of stuff. Rob Todd at Allagash in Portland, Maine. Rob does just phenomenal beers. You know, his mm-hmm. like his Allagash White, I think is probably
favorite.
Better than any other white beer, better than any of the Belgian whites now.
Hmm.
So he's doing a really, really terrific job. Vinny out at Russian River is doing a bunch of sour stuff, which
Northern
is really
California.
Cool. Yeah. You know, and sour, we like to say that sour is the new hoppy. You know, there's a lot of sour beers out now, or not a lot, but they're it's kind of the new growing trend because they work so well with food.
Mm-hmm.
He does a really good job. And then, let's see, who else do I really like? I mean, there's so many. I'm trying to think of like one more. What do I drink a lot of? Locally, I think the 6 Point stuff too is really good.
Yeah, I'm
drinking,
I like 6
again,
Point.
I'm drinking a sweet Action right now. Mm-hmm.
And the wheat beer from 6 Point is excellent.
It's my third one here today. Really
good. Isn't Sweet Action the one with a higher alcohol content?
That's why Greg limited himself to 3.
Yes.
For the show.
Only 3 during
You're
the show.
You're looking placid.
Right. Yeah.
And what
we
about...
We can give you one too, Liz.
Okay.
Who should we be on the watch out for? Like a total
yeah,
like
who's
little
an up-and-comer?
Guy. Like a little guy that no one's ever heard of, but that's just a little local treasure somewhere. Like I asked out cheese and beer.
Willie Lehner in Wisconsin is one of my picks for like weird little guy. He's doing some really crazy stuff. There's the cheese that's in the book, but he has one called Earth Schmear. And basically he had the idea that, you know, we talk about terroir and microbes and the soil and the air and the water and all that stuff. But his idea was that if he took the soil from his land and literally added water to it and then filtered the water, he would capture the microbes of his land and then washed his cheese
with it.
And it's this delicious cow's milk washed rind. It's pasteurized. It's a great example of how you can make fantastic cheese out of pasteurized milk, even though I would generally rather have a raw milk cheese myself. But mm-hmm.
Have
so
you been to his cave?
Yeah.
Cool.
And it's like totally like New Mexico, like hippie. It's got like a big sun painted on the wall. It's really weird and awesome. So he's kind of groovy. He's my pick for a little weird cheese guy.
And his name is Willie Lanton?
Willie Lehner.
Lehner.
L-A-N-E-R.
Good shout out to
L-A-I.
L-E-H-N-E-R.
Are you guys selling his cheese at Murray's?
We just bought, no, not normally, because he sells out everything he makes at the Green
really
Market
tiny.
In Madison. But we actually just bought a whole bunch of his amazing 2-year aged cloth bound cheddar, which is one of the best cloth bound cheddars I've ever had. And, he had enough, so we bought it up for January.
Does the cloth matter?
As in, like, what kind of cloth is being used? Not that I know of. I think everyone pretty much uses cheesecloth.
What makes a cloth-bound cheddar better than just a cheddar?
It's different from, like, a block cheddar, but these are wheels, not blocks. They're aged, wrapped in cheesecloth, which is generally brushed with either melted lard or melted butter, depending on the cheesemaker, which gives kind of like a ready crust for molds to feed off of. So mm-hmm. they're cave aged, they're drier, they're a bit more crumbly. They tend to have more, the complexity of flavor is deeper and better.
A lot of times
less
cloth
sharp.
Bound cheeses have a wax coating on them when they're shipped. Is that, they put that
some
on afterwards?
Some people will age, will cloth bind them and age them and then strip the cloth off and wax them so that they're sort mm-hmm. of like they stay nice and neat looking, because they can get pretty grotty looking. They get cheese mites, which is like a very fine brown dust that falls off the wheels. It's really hard to cut cloth, and that's difficult for a lot of retailers. So some people will strip it off and clean it up, but everyone we buy from just ships in cloth. So, but his cloth bound was
Liz, are you seeing
amazing.
A lot more DIY? Like, I'm sure you are, Greg.
Do-it-yourself
cheesemakers, a lot of do-it-yourself. Actually,
yeah.
I don't think so.
I mean,
Fermentation
is fermentation.
Is that easy?
People
oh, okay,
are really into experiments at home. I would say, I mean, yes, people are definitely more interested in it. We're doing a lot more classes at the shop right now that are hands-on. Even simple things like make your own mozzarella, make your own ricotta, mm-hmm. make your own fresh goat cheese. I have to say, I don't know how you feel about people brewing at home. I can't stand it when people ask me about making cheese at home. It's incredibly difficult to make good cheese, and I just, without proper equipment, I don't see how you can make... it's baffling to me. I'm sort of like,
anything
no, let a cheesemaker make the cheese. I mean, anything beyond fresh cheese, which is easy and fun, and it's actually a great thing to do with kids, and it's delicious. And
so ricotta is okay to make.
Yeah, totally.
Ricotta.
People call me and they're like, I want to make,
aged Gouda.
Cave aged Swiss cheese. And I'm like, do you realize that's a 90-pound wheel? Where are you going to get the milk? And they're sort of like, oh, well.
Where are you going to store it?
I want to make a little one. Well, no, you can't make a little one. It's a big wheel. There's a reason for that. And it totally affects the aging and the texture and all that stuff. So I get kind of,
And what's a brewer we've never heard of that, unless.
There's actually a small one out of California called The Brewery that is doing some cool Belgian stuff. Mm-hmm. And. We started making a beer called Blonde Rascal at a brew pub with lavender. And I'm like, yeah, we're the first ones to make a beer with lavender, but they actually beat us. They're making this Orchard White that I had at Spite and Dival that had lavender, and I'm like, damn.
Now let me ask, do your brewers then go on? Have any of your brewers then gone on to start their own breweries?
Oh, yeah. I like the pretty much all the local breweries in Chicago have a Goose Island guy, and we've got guys at Bell's and guys at Lakefront in Milwaukee and guys in Oregon and guys in California. Lagunitas has got some Goose Island guys. Firestone Walker, their head brewer, is an old Goose Island guy. So yeah, it's kind of like the, you know, chef game is you work at a restaurant and then you go on and
No, that's how we expand as Heritage. Well, this has been a fascinating show. It's been real energetic, hasn't it, Katie?
I think it's been a very, very good welcome back to Patrick Martin's.
I'm like all pumped. I'll go 10 hours if I need to.
Really, this has been
Katie, you're amazing. I mean, to run this show and be
so...
Oh,
stop it, Patrick.
You are absolutely...
No, but it's been a lot of fun, and thank you so much for bringing in the fabulous Greg Hall from Goose Island Brewery and Liz Hall.
Liz Thorpe. Well, not yet.
Yes. Not yet. Right.
But how many beers are you going to give
actually,
me?
After you guys cut a deal between Goose Island and Murray's, then we'll talk marriage. No.
And Katie, I had the fortunate luck to go to visit your house in Rhode Island.
Yes,
and
my family man. It's
lovely.
I know.
And I think
Southern New England Culinary Center is going to be taking place. You guys will be coming.
More people
seminars.
Need to come to that house.
Rhode Island is full of progressive agriculture. We got a lot of very cool stuff going on.
And Obama has now officially landmarked that entire state as a bed and breakfast.
Yeah. Well, he's got to do something because the unemployment rate is as high as it is in Michigan. So
it's funny. I was driving back to do with Rhode Island, but Ann pointed something funny out. Like, we noticed all these Geico signs.
Yeah.
And they have a pile of money sitting on two
eyes.
The eyeballs. Yeah.
But the
really
top
annoying.
Bill on is a five.
Like, yeah, so how much are you saying?
Like,
yeah, how about a Ben
five,
Franklin,
like
man.
A one or something? Jeez, that's a little weird.
Roll of quarters.
Yeah,
but
right.
I ate exactly at La Letterie.
La Letterie.
Oh,
Letterie.
Matt's place.
In Providence. Loved it. In fact, we ate there both nights. We drove all the way back. And,
amazing.
Great cheeses.
26 miles from where they were staying.
It's good food. Like, for someone who goes and eats a lot of burgers and grilled cheese sandwiches like I do, and does, it was very, very good. World class. I recommend it to everyone who is in
That's
Providence.
That's La Letterie in Providence, Rhode Island.
And his cheese shop is Farmstead.
Yes.
So I'm on the main course, part Q. We have Varun, who is Alice Waters' personal assistant. So that'll
be
an interesting story, I'm sure, from Varun, who's a young kid who's like basically is Alice to most people. And then
we have a phone interview with Frank Reese of Good Shepherd
Farm.
To do a post-mortem on the turkey business and to discuss the politics of poultry, because he read this very interesting blog post from somebody in the industrialized agriculture sector of poultry raising. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have an interesting talk about
that.
And I'd
love to talk to him. He knows every single saint.
Oh, really?
In the world.
Oh,
and
my
in fact,
God.
I think
I have
he should do a show.
He's done books about saints.
Oh, no.
And
Frank
my friend
knows
Erica
much.
Is doing a... She has a whole companion blog to Barbara's Saints of menus for Saints' Days. Anyway, that's another show.
We'll be back in 15 minutes.
Thank
in
you
the
very
meantime,
much to
Jack.
Liz Thorpe and to Greg Hall. Greg, you're saying something. You want to say something? I can tell.
Goose Island and Murray's doing an event on the 26th of February. Blues... And brews.
Where?
Oh,
at
Murray's.
Yeah.
Murray's Cheese. 254
so you'll be back,
Bleecker
hopefully
Street.
Here, too.
In the West Village.
Give
oh,
us
fantastic.
A heads up.
So you'll come back to promote that, right?
Yeah, you guys have been great.
Great. Thank you so much for coming, you two, and we'll see you very soon.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Nosso amor não vai olhar para trás, desencantar, nem ser tema de livro. A vida inteira eu quis verso simples pra transformar o que eu digo. Rimas fáceis.